obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hello, my name's Matthew and I'm an alcoholic. I just want to start off today by saying I think that we should note that on Easter Sunday, happy Easter, by the way, in this room full of hopeless and powerless alcoholics, there are well over 2,000 years of sobriety. I'd also like to say I was expecting fewer of you. Why aren't you home with your families? But I know, in some sense, that we are absolutely home with our families today here. I want to thank Jeff for being such a kind host to me. He leaves his cell phone on, Al, and I was able to reach him when I had little tiny things that I needed to know about, like where the hell is this conference, things like that. It's my great prayer before I start this speaking is that I will talk to you a lot about what keeps me here and a little about what got me here. I do feel I have to qualify as an alcoholic, and I can't tell you how pleased I am that you're not eating while I do that. I'm pleased for you. I didn't drink a lot when I was younger. My parents were good, honest, hardworking people. They were not alcoholics. I know from hearing many, many fifth steps in AA that that's not true for all of us. But I can tell you that I want to honor my parents today because they passed on and that they were good and loving people. However, there was alcoholism in my immediate family. My brother, I'm the youngest of four in an Irish Catholic family. And my brother, yeah, I belong here. And my brother was, who was just older than me, but he's 7 years older than me. I was a bit of a surprise in a Catholic family. And he was a terrible drunk, and I loved him dearly. And my home life was very chaotic because of him. So when other of my friends were sneaking off and drinking early in high school, I didn't do it because I could clearly see that alcohol was his problem. However, I will tell you about my first drunk, and this is the part where I'm glad you're not eating. And I went to my junior year of high school. I can't remember if it was my junior or senior year, but I went to a small Catholic school, and I hung out with, there were six of us that hung out, and we were the most popular guys. And the way I looked at that is there were five popular guys and me, and that they hung out with me as a favor to me. For 12 years, they did that, and I had some issues. And we went to one of their houses in Hermosa Beach, overlooking the ocean, and their parents were out of town. This guy's parents were out of town, and we had a Catholic school party. That's six guys and a bottle of tequila. There were no girls, which I noticed right away. But these guys, they were athletes, and I was a musician, and they were cool, and I didn't feel like I was. And they started drinking tequila, and I didn't drink, thank you, because of what was going on quietly and privately and secretly in my house. But I just couldn't stand the feeling of separation while they were enjoying this alcohol. So I said, I'll have a drink, and they poured me a shot glass, and you guys know the story. I drank that shot glass, and 12 years of Catholic school guilt melted from my shoulders. It tickles me pink that I'm standing here at the spiritual breakfast on Sunday morning. I can tell you the nuns of St. James and the Franciscans of Bishop Montgomery are rolling over in their graves that I'm the spiritual speaker. Thank you, Father Terry. Anyway, so I immediately had this warm sensation and great feeling of love for the world because of this tequila, and I went and got a quaff cup, is what we called them in college, big cup, and I said, can I have some more tequila, please? And they filled the cup up, and we were having a great time. I was articulate and handsome and funny and Eric Clapton, and you know. And I decided to go down the hall to go to the bathroom, and this is the first time I'd ever been drunk, and I went down the hall of this beautiful house, and I walked into this marble bathroom, and this is where God first enters my story. I sat down on the toilet to go to the bathroom, and the room started to spin. And my last thought before I blacked out was that God would not make a body that could defecate and vomit at the same time. And I was wrong. Apparently, he designs you exactly that way. And I lurched towards the sink. And that's all I remember. I woke up the next day on the floor of this bathroom in a sleeping bag with a pillow under my head like I had gone camping in the bathroom. I've since sent all of those guys CODA literature. But I was completely cleaned up and thought, how the hell did I end up camping in the bathroom? And about halfway through that day of school, it dawned on me what had happened. And I was filled with remorse and shame. And I've been to many, many speaker meetings, and I've heard people say that they took that drink, that first drink, they felt that feeling, they got sick as a dog, and they couldn't wait to do it again. And because of the balance of my home life and that incredible Catholic guilt that just, it just cues up, you know, I just did not want to do that again. I thought, oh my God, I'm just like my brother. And the thing is, I used to hear my brother fight with my parents, and he'd disappear for weeks at a time in high school. And my only thought was, how could anybody treat those good people so badly? And so I didn't drink again in high school. But then I went to Chico State. just before I went to Chico State, my brother got sober. He had gotten his high school girlfriend pregnant. We had done everything we could for him. We did group therapy and then tough love. This was the 80s, and we put him out in his car. He lived out in his car. And then he said, I've gone to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have 90 days or something. And my parents said, well, you can live with us while you get your life together. And he would lie in the bathtub the summer before I went to college, and he would read this blue book. And I would shave and look at him and think, what could possibly be in that book that we haven't tried? Because look at him, he's back. He's the guy I love and admire, and he's doing so well, and he's humble, and he's quiet. He's totally changed, and he was reading this blue book in the bathtub. So I went off to college, and somewhere on I-5 between the Grapevine and Chico, you forget all about I'm not going to drink alcohol anymore. And I hate to tell you, if there's any parents who are going off to college, in my first week at Chico, I started drinking alcoholically. I took acid, snorted cocaine, and smoked a lot of pot. Higher education. And that's just my experience. It may not be your kid's experience. It was just my experience. And I felt part of. I felt part of. All of a sudden, all those hours and hours of practicing, playing guitar in my room were paying off. There were three girls to every guy at Chico State. I had a date every year. And I was in a band, and I was doing my thing. And then it struck me that I wasn't going to class. And I got a degree in literature. I was attempting to get a degree in literature, and I realized that drinking was a problem, and it started caved in on me that it's like 3 months into school that I was just like my brother. And that terrified me. I did not want to do that. So I stopped drinking, and I didn't know that what I was experiencing was a dry drunk until years later when I met you people. But my girlfriend at the time came and brought me a six-pack and said, please drink this. You are such an a-hole right now. And who am I to argue with medicine? And I drank it and forgot I wasn't drinking. I just was off and running. So that's how it started. And I'd like to kind of fast forward to how it ended, because what I'm really, really passionate about is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the journey of recovery and action. Yeah, thank you. So fast forward 10 years, and I had graduated from college. I learned the key to graduating with a degree in literature is to read books while smoking pot. And then when you go to class, make sure you smoke pot, because you're going to take a test on that book you read while you were smoking pot. And I'm not kidding. I've learned there's actually a term for this. It's called conditioned learning. When I moved into my house with my wife, she had given me a book called 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and it's an absolutely stunning work. And I read it, and I loved it so much, I kept waking her up to read passages to her, and she goes, I know, it's a great book, And but the ending page is just phenomenal. And I am moving into my house with her about a year later, and I'm moving this file cabinet drawer, and this paper keeps flipping on the top, and I pull it out, and it's a paper I wrote in college on a book called 100 Years of Solitude, and I didn't remember a word of it. So I'm convinced today if I smoke a joint, I would be like the CEO of the biggest company around, because I'd remember all of college. I've had to struggle against a huge blackout. But anyway, so I did graduate from college, and I pursued my dream, and I became a musician. I became a musician, which I'd always wanted to do, and I'd worked very, very hard to do it. And I'd saved my money, and I'd bought the correct instruments and the correct equipment, and I practiced, and I took lessons, and I practiced and practiced and practiced because I love music. There's something about it that's indescribable to me. It just shakes me. And I ended up on the East Coast playing in a band, and they kicked me out. I was 29 or 30 years old. And I had drunk myself out of a rock and roll band. Need I qualify more? I mean, that's like Keith Richards going, "You gotta cool out, man." You know. So I was shocked when they said I drank too much. I was like, "Are you kidding? We're a rock and roll band, man." And but you know, I would miss the bus. And you can't miss the bus, you know. If you play lead guitar, you need to be there. And I actually stole a car once because I borrowed it, but I just went to the next town. It had the keys in it. It seemed like a community car. And I drove it to the next town and to catch up with the bus. And I left a very nice note about the address that I took it from. And please return this car if you find it. And I made it to the bus, so I wasn't that bad, but I got kicked out, and I came home, and you know, I went to the East Coast. My mother, who I dearly loved, was diagnosed with cancer and did not have a good prognosis, and I went to the East Coast anyway to play with this band. And when I came back, I lied, and I told everybody that I came back to take care of my mother and to be near my mother, and that was absolutely a lie. If I could have stayed away forever playing music and getting loaded every day, I would have done it if I could have gotten away with it. But I had nowhere else to go but home. I had to take a Greyhound bus with my last dollars, with all my equipment stuck on the load to get home. And I got home, and I got a job that was beneath me at Marie Callender's in Hermosa Beach as a waiter. And they quickly found out that I'd gone to college, and they made me a manager. And I remember when they were training me to be a manager, and I thought, God, manager, that's kind of beneath me too. You know, I have an honors degree in literature, and I'm a rock star. You know, what the hell am I doing here? But I remember when they were training me to be the manager, they're like, here's the kitchen, here's the freezer, here's the bar, here's the keys to the bar, and then he went, wah, 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 wah. I was like, the keys to the bar? And they kept talking, and I kept looking at the keys. And this happened many, many times. I was the weekend and night manager, and we served breakfast too. So on Friday and Saturday nights, after we closed, I'd open up the bar for the waitresses and myself, and we would drink, and they'd all go home eventually, which seemed like unbelievably ungrateful behavior. I would drink and pass out at the bar, and I would many times, this did not happen once, I would wake up with the sun pouring into that bar with bottles everywhere. I haven't done the books. And the morning manager's coming down the street to open the bar. So I would run through the bar and stop in front of the alarm system because I have to set the alarm for the 14 seconds that no one's going to be in the restaurant. And I'd set the alarm and run out and hide on the floor of my car. The only car in the parking lot. You know, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. And this guy was so funny. He'd pull up right next to my car. And then he'd get out and glance into my car, and I'm like, I don't think he knows I'm here. And he'd go into the restaurant and clean up my mess. And right after one of the waitresses got pregnant by me. I used to say she got pregnant. I got her pregnant. Through the work of Alcoholics Anonymous in a four-step, I found out I had a part in it. And it's amazing what you can learn if you do these steps. But I ended up, they fired me. You know, this job that was clearly beneath me, they fired me because I was absolutely unable to do it. And I remember that this girl had literally told me like the day before that she was pregnant. And I don't mean any disrespect to her, but if you had lined up the waitresses at Marie Callender's and said, which one of them do you want to accidentally get pregnant? I would have said, not her. Maybe her. Not her. And because my perception was that she was a self-centered, spoiled Manhattan Beach girl. My perception was that she was self-centered. I was 30 years old. She was 18. See, the guys always applaud. That's been, I go to men's stag meetings. I have a warped view of AA. So I got fired, and I remember I had been up all night drinking when I came to work and got fired, and I had a shirt on and my lame Marie Callender's manager badge and this knit tie. Remember knit ties? And I walked across the street to go to the bus station because that car had been taken away because of a DUI that I had. And across the street there in Hermosa Beach, there's a school for autistic and mildly retarded kids, like severely autistic and mildly retarded children to adults to learn how to live on their own. And I walked up to this bus stop, and there are about 10 or 12 of these autistic and retarded adults. And I walked up, and I'm crying, and I got snot coming out of my nose because I lost this crappy job, and I got this girl pregnant. And like, what happened to me, you know? And I stepped off the curb to see if the bus was coming because it couldn't come fast enough. And 12 retarded people yelled, "Don't stand in the street! Don't stand in the street!" And I remember thinking, you know, retarded people are teaching me how to wait for a bus. And sadly, that was not my bottom. So I got on the bus and I wrote and I got home to my apartment and I got off the bus and I sincerely and very sincerely tried to drink myself to death. I couldn't believe that this had happened, you know. My parents were married for 50 years to each other. I never heard my father insult my mother, not once. I knew better. I knew better. I was raised with love and kindness and direction, and I was taught character, and I was taught right from wrong, and I pawned it. I pawned the character and the lessons in life that I had learned to pay for the party. And I got to my house, and I tried to drink myself to death. And there's a part in the Big Book and the Promises that says, you will not regret the past nor wish to close the door on it, because no matter how far down the scale you have gone, you will see how your experience can help others. And with that in mind, I will tell you that when that girl was 8 months pregnant, I pushed her down a flight of stairs. And it wasn't because I wanted to hurt her, and it wasn't because I wanted to hurt that baby. It was because I didn't have a single feeling in me for them. I wanted to get loaded, and they were screwing up my high. And I tell you that because that's where alcoholism took me. I was dead inside, absolutely dead. And I had come from a rich experience. We joke about Irish Catholics' upbringings. There's no more fun place to grow up than an Irish family. With music and stories and love and religion. What's wrong with that? And I threw all that away because I wanted to feel good all the time. I didn't like that guilt. I didn't like my thinking. And you know how it gets. Once you start drinking, the problems from the drinking build up, and you got to drink to hold those problems. Pretty soon someone's pregnant. Pretty soon you're, you know, being taught lessons in bus stop waiting, and life gets hard. And my life got hard, and I tried to die from drinking. And my sobriety date is May 16th, 1993. And my home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag at Hermosa Beach. And about May 14th, 1993, around that time was Mother's Day. And my brother, who was sober like 12 years, called me up and said, "Hey, we're going to celebrate Mother's Day down at the harbor. Well, I'll pick you up, you know." I actually had bought a car. I had a $200 AMC. I've never seen an AMC since that, and I know why. They're not very good cars. And But my brother came to pick me up, and my mom was alive but not doing well, and he wanted to take me to Mother's Day, and he said, make sure you're there, I'm going to pick you up. And I put a clean shirt on my dirty body. I'd been up drinking and doing other things, and I weighed 108 pounds. That I know, I weigh 170 pounds now, and I'm not any taller. So I got taken to, my brother picked me up and went to Mother's Day, and I sat there, and I had that deluded thinking that if I just talked a lot, no one would notice that my life was a mess and that I weighed 108 pounds and that I was unemployed and that I had a teenage girlfriend who was about to have a baby, and it didn't work. I didn't make any sense. They looked at me aghast, but let me go. They let me go. No one confronted me. They just acted like I wasn't there, and I was so filled with shame. I love these people. I dearly love these people. I had a tremendous amount of respect for them, and I was the fool. I went from the golden boy to the fool. And my brother drove me home, and we got in an argument, and we've talked about this since, and we don't know what we argued about. I would love to know, because I felt that I had the moral higher ground. And he was, you know, sober, married, children, going to visit mom. I used to call my mom many times and say, I'm going to come visit you, mom. And somewhere between, and I live 2 miles away, between the phone and the door, I just had to have one drink, just one, so I could go visit her. And I didn't go ever. And I tell you that because that's where alcoholism took me. I wanted to go. I meant to go. But after the first drink, it suddenly was midnight. And I'm drunk, and I don't know why I did this again, and I'm ashamed. And I thought, well, that's all right, I'll call her tomorrow. And I did that, and I did that, and I did that. So on the way home, we had this argument. I got out of my car, I went into my apartment, and I was so angry about whatever that I paced around my apartment, and I waited for him to have enough time to get home, and I called him up, and I started yelling at him. And he said, he waited till I totally ran out of steam. And he said, you know, Matthew, I think you may have a problem with alcohol and drugs. And I don't know why I said this, and without any sarcasm, this is truly the moment where God entered my life and grace entered my life, because I said to him, of course I do. And people had been telling me I had a problem with alcohol and drugs for years. I could have stayed in that band if I'd shaped up, but they didn't understand. I could have stayed in those relationships with those wonderful girls, but they didn't understand. I don't have a problem with alcohol. What's their problem? But he said it. My brother, and I said, of course I do. And he said, I'm going to come over. Don't go anywhere. And I remember thinking as I hung up the phone that my brother was going to come to my house, kick my ass, and I'd never drink again. And that's the downside of the Irish Catholic family thing. I one time lent my bike to a neighbor, and I never lent it to my brother because he was an alcoholic. And every time I lent him something, he sold it. So I didn't lend my bike to my brother, but I lent it to a neighbor, and my brother saw the neighbor ride by, and as he beat me up, he goes, I'm family! Family comes first! So it wasn't unusual for me to think that he was going to come beat me up and I'd never drink again, and in a way, I welcomed it. I was so full of self-loathing, you know. I was so scared of the world and hateful of myself, and with equal parts arrogance. And my brother showed up, and I had been hiding out in this apartment. I had actually, for 6 or 7 months, just stayed in the apartment. It was right next to the beach. And I would sit on the couch, and when someone would come up on the porch, I'd hold my breath because I didn't want anyone to know I was inside. I was afraid of them. It was a lot of times the mailman, and he was putting that ugly red mail in your mailbox, you know, last notice, final, big obnoxious mail that no one brings in. And I would hold my breath. The one time I went out, I used to wear these surgical pants you remember that when they were popular, like from ORs or whatever? I don't know where I got them, but I wore them for months. And I was staying home. You know, why change? And I remember I thought, you know, I live right next to the beach. I think I'll go outside on the porch and smoke a cigarette. And with God as my witness, I walked outside and a DEA SWAT team ran through my courtyard of my apartment complex. And those surgical pants became unwearable right at that second. And I had a reaction. And they ran through my apartment complex, and I stumbled back into my house and down the hall to change my clothes. And later on, I kind of talk to some people in the neighborhood. I go, did you see that DEA? They go, oh, yeah, there was a drug dealer across the alley. And my response was, there was a drug dealer across the alley? I have to wait hours. So, you know, not, ooh, I missed that bullet. It was like, God damn it. So this is your spiritual speaker, folks. So anyway, my brother's coming to this apartment that I haven't left in a while. And I'll never forget this. He walked in, inhaled, and goes, let's go to the beach. It was a little ripe in there. And there's, you know, dishes. What dishes? And I remember I grabbed a pack of Marlboro Reds. I grabbed a pack and a half of Marlboro Reds and went down to the beach with him. And we sat on a lifeguard stand at Avenue A in Redondo Beach. And he did this unbelievable thing. He started talking to me about how he felt when he was in high school and he was arguing with mom and dad all the time. And he started talking to me about how he felt when he got that girl pregnant and no one wanted to support him. And he started talking to me about how he felt when he moved into his car because even his parents wouldn't let them in the house. And he started talking to me about how I felt. Now, I didn't think anybody in the world knew how I felt. And the last person that I expected that knew how I felt was my brother. And he said it to me. He told my innermost secrets to me. And I started to trust him. Here he was sitting in front of me, healthy, clear-eyed, visiting mom, supporting his family, unafraid. And there I was, 108 pounds, smoking a pack and a half of Marlboro Reds. And when I got done with all 30 cigarettes, I threw up my hands and I said, all right, I'll go to AA. And he laughed and goes, AA, dude, you're going to a hospital. And I said this to him and I truly meant it. And I go, I'm really busy. I don't think I can go to a hospital. And I meant it. I said, well, how long are these hospital things? And he goes, I don't know, 28 days, 30 days. And I'm like, dude, man, I can't. I'm sitting on the couch. The plates will fall. The balls will fall, you know. And really, I don't know about you, but I remember crystal clear the reason I couldn't get sober is because if I got sober, all the furniture that was spinning around the room was going to hit me in the head. All those problems that were like, I was kind of going, I don't have those problems, were going to fall in on me, you know. But I have good news from Garrison Keillor. He says, time is so everything doesn't happen at once, and space is so everything doesn't happen to you. And that's what I figured out later on in recovery. So anyway, it took a couple days to work out the hospital. And on May 16th, 1993, when I was ready to go to this hospital, my phone rang. And they said, hey, your daughter was born today. So I go, oh, I better find that AMC. And I went looking for my car. And I found it. It wasn't easy, but I found it. And I went to a hospital. It wasn't the right hospital, but I went to a hospital. And I said, I think my daughter's here. No, 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 but maybe you should stay. And I said, no, we got important business. We're going to take care of that later. And I drove off to the right hospital. And the grace of God, I was walking in to the hospital glass doors as the parents of this teenage girl, the mother of my daughter, were walking out. And I went upstairs to this hospital room, and Anna, who's my daughter's mother, jumped out of bed and said, come see your daughter. And she put this girl in my arms. And I remember thinking, how could anything as beautiful as this have anything to do with me? I was a negative person. I was underground. I was a liar. I couldn't tell the truth even if it served me better. And I looked at this perfect, lovely ball of love that was yanking on something inside of me. And I hoped for her that I would have nothing to do with her. My prayer for her was that she'd find a capable person to be her father. And my sponsor says there's a moment of clarity when you know that everything is going to be all right. I did not have that moment. I had that moment of, I am a complete piece of shit, really, actually. And just self-loathing, terrible, terrible self-loathing, bitter and incomprehensible demoralization at its peak. And I left that hospital just stunned because I had made this and I had responsibility for this. And I got into another car, a much better car, and was taken to the hospital. I remember my parents drove me out to this hospital in Palm Springs, and it was like the first day of kindergarten. You know, they let me out of the car, and I was like, come back, you know, and, you know, and they didn't come back. They didn't come back in kindergarten either. They're actually really bad parents, but they left me there in my fear. And it was my great fear. I did not have my medicine, and I did not know you people. I was terrified. And I went into that hospital, and I slept for 4 days, and I gained 47 pounds. My body was like, thank you. No more gin and donuts, you know. And because I used to go to the liquor store next door and get these yogurts that were like this big, because that's healthy, right? Yogurt. And 6 white powder donuts every couple days, whether I needed it or not. And that's how I ended up weighing 108 pounds. So I went into this hospital, scariest day of my life. We did some stuff in there. I came out the other end. Second scariest day of my life is walking out into the world now. Because you remember that feeling? How many people went into a 30-day program? Okay, remember how they were your best friends and you were going to stay sober forever together? Where are those people? So my brother, who was at an AA conference out in Palm Springs, picked me up at the hospital, my sober brother. And we drove to a gas station, and we were talking, and he got out of the car, and he says, why don't you drive? I thought, wow, he's never done that. This sober thing's great. 30 days, and you get to drive his car. And I drove his car, and he fell asleep, like immediately fell asleep. So we got home, and we pulled up in front of my apartment, and he pushed me out of the car and said, go to a meeting. And I had other plans. I wanted to go see my daughter. I wanted to get my life together. I was going to look for a job, all that stuff. And my brother later told me that he pretended to be asleep because I was so full of newcomer bullshit, he could hardly stand listening to me. You know, I was going, I took a fifth step, and I'm, you know, I'm on a spiritual path, and I'm going to take care of mom, and I'm going to be a great dad. I'm going to be a great dad. And he was like, whoa. You drive. And you know what? I was just scared. I was talking because I was scared. My 6-year-old who's upstairs, I don't look like it, but I'm the Easter Bunny. And my 6-year-old is upstairs at this hotel. And last night she was walking around the hotel room going, I'm sober, I'm sober, I'm sober. And my wife goes, what do you think it means to be sober? And she goes, oh, it means you talk a lot. Clearly that's based on her personal experience with sobriety. So anyway, my brother kicked me out of the car, and I thought, well, I'm not going to go to a meeting today. I've just had 30 days of intensive VA, you know, I'm going to go do some stuff. And I walked into my apartment, and they handed me a beer. It actually wasn't a beer, it was a Coors, and they were snorting Coke on my glass table, and they were smoking pot in my kitchen, and I lived at that apartment all by myself. So my lower companions had found out I'd left and moved in. And I had this beer in my hand, and I started to shake because I realized it didn't look so bad. And I didn't want to go back. I couldn't go back. So I was so scared, and I put that Coors down, and I backed out of my own apartment, and I walked around, terrified, lost, alone. I was dreaming of the people at the hospital, someone who knew what I was going through. And I remembered what my brother said, and I remember what they said at that rehab. And I went to a payphone, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And because people do service work, somebody answered the phone. I've been to towns where I've gotten the machine. And I don't think if I got the machine that day, I would be standing here today. So I got a human being who said, there's a great meeting right around the corner from where you are. I told him the corner I was at. And I was afraid. I was afraid of you. And I walked around that meeting block a couple of times, kind of building up my courage, getting my cool up to walk into an AA meeting. I walked in, and I was like 45 minutes early. And there was one guy, George O, standing there setting up chairs. And I walked up to him and said, I'm new, and I'm scared. And he said, I know what to do for you. Set up the rest of these chairs. And I was so glad that I could do that. And I set those chairs up, and he sat next to me. He goes, well, tell me, what's going on? And I told him almost everything I've already told you. Because when you're sober means you talk a lot. And I got done with all this, and he stood me by the door, and he introduced me to everybody who came into that meeting. He said, this is Matthew. He's new. Hello. This is Matthew. He's new. Hello. And some of my brother's friends came in. They go, hey, Matthew, you're out. It's so good to see you. And I sat down in that speaker meeting, and I had the moment of clarity. I was going to be all right. And I'll never forget what that speaker said. He got up to the podium, and he said, wah, 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 wah. Wah, 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 wah. Wah, 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 wah. And I looked around like, I think I'm going to be all right. And apparently it's a Charlie Brown meeting. And I went home and I moved out of my apartment in the middle of the night. I moved out of my apartment in the middle of the night. And I called my parents. And like my sponsor said, I think he said it Friday, all tough guys live with mom and dad. And I took my tough guy rock and roll ass and I moved in with mom and dad. And but the truth was, speaking of that, I was once spoke at a meeting and some girl came up to me and said, you are dangerous. And you know, I know what she meant, you know, like dangerous, like motorcycles and black leather jackets. And that's not true. I was dangerous. I was ultimately dangerous because my selfishness knew no bounds. I mean, I ruined that girl's idea of her life, that 18-year-old. She wanted to go to college. I just said, you're not doing that because I want to have sex with you. Because I want to feel good. I didn't care about anybody, and I knew better. So here I am in sobriety with 30 days, dazed at my parents' house in my old bedroom. And I got up in the morning, I went to an AA meeting, and I found out where there was one at noon. And a guy who was at the noon meeting was at the night meeting I went to, and I walked up to him and I said, will you be my sponsor? And he looked right at me, and he didn't say yes. He didn't introduce himself. He said, do you have a job? What a weird question. And I said, no, I don't have a job. And he said, well, get a job. That's your first assignment. And I said, well, what kind of job should I get? And he looked at me and goes, the kind with a paycheck. And the reason I'd asked him to, I know, he hasn't ever gotten any nicer. And the reason I asked him, spiritual giant that he is, and I asked him for the reason I wanted him to be my sponsor, and it was, and I'm not kidding, is they told me in the hospital, find a guy in AA who has what you want. And this guy seemed comfortable in his own skin, and he had a decent used car. And I was just, that's about where I was shooting from. It's like, comfortable, I'll take it. When they say relief from the bondage of self, I know exactly what they're talking about, and I wanted it. So I went to these meetings. I got a few days. You know, people were going, the 12 steps, they're tools for living. They're tools for living. And I thought, well, then you shouldn't have written them in Chinese. Because I have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, where's the IRS step? You know, where's the baby step? Where's the lawyers? Is there somebody useful here? Because I'm in trouble, man. And I didn't understand it because they didn't. There's a guy, Bob, who goes to our noon meetings, Meter Maid Bob, and he always says, you know, they didn't address my issues. And I had some issues. And I remember at 60 days sober, around that time, I was talking to my sponsor and I said, I love being a father. I can't believe how much love I have for this little girl. Phoebe's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I thought it was the worst thing. It's the greatest thing. And he didn't respond. And what I was doing, and he knew it, but I didn't really realize it, was I was trying to manipulate him into thinking I was a good person. Because who can argue with, I love my daughter? And he didn't argue. He just didn't say anything. So a couple of days later, because I need attention, I started this rap again. And I said, yeah, I really love my daughter. I'm really going to be a good dad because I'm sober, and I just can't believe that I have this daughter. And he put his hand up to stop me from talking. And he said, how much child support do you pay? And I went, yeah, I work at this newspaper from midnight to 4 in the morning, and then I deliver packages from 7 in the morning till noon, and then I go to meetings, and I live with my parents. I said, wow, that didn't answer my question. How much child support are you paying? And I go, well, I'm not paying any. And he goes, then you're full of shit, huh? And I was so mad. And I go, what do you mean? And he goes, this is a program of action. This is not a program of talk. don't tell me you love your daughter. Show me. And I went back to my parents' house, and I walked around my old bedroom, red-faced and angry, because clearly I had to find another sponsor. And this guy didn't appreciate me. He didn't understand the intricacies of my love for my daughter. And but the reason I had a red face and the reason I was so angry is because he was absolutely right. I was full of it. I was completely full of it. So rather than call him and break up with him, I called Anna. And I said, Anna, you know, I'm making a little bit of money. I'll give you a certain percentage of my paycheck every 2 weeks. And we agreed on the percentage. And she said, boy, that would really help. That would be great. So I did that. I paid every 2 weeks. I wrote a check to Anna. First thing, boom, this percentage of my paycheck. And if I had two jobs, it was the percentage of the total. And I gave her the check. And this weird thing happened. I would go into meetings, you know, big speaker meetings. And I'd walk through the door and you guys didn't stand up and start applauding. And I checked the paper every day and there was no announcement that Matthew's a hell of a guy. And there was no Matthew Pace Child Support surprise party. And and you're laughing because you know what I mean. Because remember when you got your license, you're sober a while and you get your license and there's no surprise party. And then finally someone who loves you goes, dude, you're 40, man. You should have a license. And you're like, oh, yeah, right. And so what happened to me was the most important thing about paying that check was nobody knew. That became the value in it. Nobody knew but Anna and me. And every couple of weeks, I'd pay this thing, and a couple months went by, and I noticed that I didn't feel like a piece of shit anymore. I felt like a person who was trying. I felt like a guy who was really doing his best. It wasn't much, but it was his best. And I carried that lesson with me into sponsorship. And when I sponsor a guy, and if you sponsor anybody, you've heard this, I'm going to put myself on the top of my 8-step list because clearly I've hurt myself the worst. And I'm Irish. I got a lot of sarcasm in me. And I never say what I'm thinking. I say, you know what, man? Maybe if you put yourself at the bottom of that list and you make every other amends, it won't be necessary to make amends to yourself anymore. Because that's my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. All of those amends are amends to myself. I pawned my character to pay for the party. You got to buy it back. So, and I want to mention another story about the ninth step, because that clearly is not the ninth step. Child support is a responsibility, but you guys understand what I'm trying to say. And I did owe a guy, I had sort of taken over that apartment. I had a roommate and he'd moved to another country and he was keeping the apartment and I was supposed to pay him rent. And through various scams, I screwed that guy out of $15,000. And when we got to my eighth step, I wrote his name and, you know, $10 million. It said $15,000, but clearly it looked like $10 million, you know. And there were other amends, but that one just seemed like, wow, $10 million. I don't really have that. And I had this sort of vision that I had to take a briefcase with $15,000 to his house and go, sorry, you know. But I have good sponsorship, and my sponsor said, you know, write him a letter. He lived in Mexico City at the time, and send him a check for as much as you can afford. So I did. I sent him a check for $10 and wrote him a letter, and I sent it off. And it was a long letter, and it was heartfelt because I really liked this guy. He was a good person to me, and we were good friends before I did all that. So I sent this letter off. And, you know, my mother did die. My mother died in my arms, and I had made amends to her. And she died in my arms, and I was clean, pure and clean with my mother. And I was in love with her, and I was a son. And I was a son because I was taught how to be one in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor said to me, because I would say, my mom's getting really sick. I think maybe, you know, I could hire a string quartet or something to go over there to play for her. Or maybe I could bring her some food from this restaurant she likes. And he goes, man, you are so grandiose. Why don't you try being a son? Why don't you go sit next to that hospital bed a half hour longer than it's comfortable for you? I am so glad he said that, because I didn't have the money for that other stuff, and I was grandiose. It was stupid. And I went to her bed, and I sat there a half hour after it was so comfortable. It's uncomfortable watching someone you love die.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
It's uncomfortable being with sick people in general, but with sick people who you can't bear it that they're sick, it's uncomfortable. And I sat there with her, and I made amends to her. I said the amends to her, and I demonstrated my amends. I changed my behavior. I amended my behavior. And when she died, I was clean, and I let her go. Let her go be with God. And that was a beautiful, beautiful moment in my life. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Because truly, truly, I want to say this about a higher power. When I came out of that rehab and I went to my first AA meeting, I was nervous. And then when I came back the next week, I noticed that some of the people that were there the first week were sitting in the same chairs. And that gave me a little bit of comfort. And then they started to share, and I started to hear them. The next week, I'd hear a guy, and he'd say something. I'd go, man, that's how I was. That's how I acted. And I started relaxing a little more. And then I'd come again, and all the regulars were there, and I'm starting to know their names, and they're welcoming me, and I have a commitment, and I'm starting to feel at home. That, my friends, is a higher power. I couldn't make those people sit there. I couldn't do that. I had no power over that. A million things happened to get every one of those people in those chairs. Clearly, that's a power greater than myself that restored me to sanity. So if you're saying here, sitting here, and you have 6 months of sobriety or 2 years of sobriety, and you're going, I don't get the God thing. That's like driving on the 405 freeway in a car going, I don't get the engine thing. Right? It's all semantics now. Yeah. You just have a problem with the word. You have no problem with the force of the Spirit, or you wouldn't be sitting here today. So I was paying this money back, and my mother died, and I was taking care of my father, which was uncomfortable. It was also uncomfortable. I loved him dearly. He was a good man to me, and I always hesitate whether I should. I'm just going to say it. You know, it's... I had to help him go to the bathroom, and at one point, I'm his youngest, and he always treated me like I was about seven. And he grabbed my hand, and he goes, I don't know how you wipe your ass, but that's a little harsh. So I calmly told him that I would get the next person in line who was waiting for this honor to come on in and do it. And it was... You know, I didn't like taking care of my father, but I'd love to do it again. I'd love to do it again. I loved him dearly. But during the time I'm taking care of my father, this guy, I paid this guy back years and years of checks. And he called me. I'd paid him $7,000 back, so I owed him $8,000. And he called me and he said, stop sending me those checks. And I go, what? And he said, you know, you've just become this guy that I always knew you could be. I'm so grateful to you. He goes, you know, nobody ever paid me back anything. And here you send these things every month, and I'd send more money or less money, depending on how I was doing. And he said, you've already paid me back. And I made the mistake of calling my sponsor. To brag that I had finished my amends. And he listened to me, and I to this day, I want to be as cool as this guy. He listened to me, and he goes, oh, okay, uh-huh. I go, yeah, I don't have to pay him back. He goes, that's that guy you started paying back when you lived with your mom and your dad. And I go, right. And he goes, yeah, now you live on your own. You got this great job. He goes, hey, man, you want to stop doing what's working? That's cool. Why do we call these guys? So, My father passed away. He died of a broken heart. He said to me when hospice came through the door, I want to meet your mother. How can you deny a man that with that great love? And he went to meet my mother, and he left me some money, and I wrote a check for $8,000, and I put it in a FedEx envelope, and I sent it to Larry, who now lived in Newport Beach. And again, a true AA miracle. This is a true, true story. Larry called me up when he got it, and he said, Matthew, I'm sitting here and I'm looking at my wife and we're about to have a baby, and we're trying to figure out our finances so we can buy a house, and we're $8,000 short of a down payment. So the flake, the loser, helped this guy buy a house with his own money. I'm forced to say that it was his money, but I held on to it for him until he absolutely needed it, and that happens here. Stuff like that happens here if you get into action. Into action. When I was sitting on my couch, I was not into action. When I was writing $10 million checks, that's action. And the reason I nailed the ninth step is because I don't know if you guys do it down here, but up where in Hermosa Beach and Long Beach at noon meetings, a lot of the time the format is somebody reads a paragraph from the big book and then we share about it. And the paragraph that a lot of people pick is the spiritual life is not a theory, you have to live it. And it may surprise some of you. I know it surprised me that paragraph is not in the third step section of the big book. And it's not in the 11th step section of the big book. It's in the ninth step section of the big book. To live a spiritual life means to make restitution for the harms you have caused others. That is living a spiritual life. I pray and I meditate. I pray and I meditate. But I grow spiritually when I do the counterintuitive thing that my sponsor tells me to do. Clearly, that's spiritual living. And I didn't know that, and I wouldn't have come up with that by myself. And I went to my sponsor at another point in my sobriety, and I said, you know, I am starting to understand Chinese, and I realize that these are tools for living. I have done a fourth step, and a fifth step, and a seventh step, and an eighth step, and some ninth step work, and I believe you. But this 11th step, I have a problem with. Because it says, prayed only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. And I'm Catholic. And God has only talked to me a couple of times. And it was to tell me that I'm going to hell. And that you're a terrible, terrible person. And you should feel guilty all the time. You know, it's weird, but when I was 14, I masturbated. I know. Once. And the nuns told me that I was going to go to hell if I did that. So I pretty much made peace with going to hell. And so, because I was powerless. This is your spiritual speaker, folks. This is why the nuns are doing cartwheels. So I had a problem with trying to figure out what God's will for me was. I did. I had a block. I felt ashamed in God's presence. I didn't understand it. I was scared. You know, when you make a third step, you don't know what that means till you've made the other steps. Then this higher power thing starts to take some shape. So I did this thing. I told my sponsor, how do I know God's will for me? And again, he didn't give me an immediate answer. He thought about it. He just sat there kind of looking at me. And then the next break at a different meeting, I said, you know, can we talk about that? I want to do this. Sought through prayer and meditation, you know, improve praying only for knowledge of God's will for me. How do I know? And he said something that changed my life. He said, Matthew, it's so simple, you can't see it. It's so simple, God's will for you. If a check comes in the mail and it says, pay this amount, God's going, pay that amount. If the alarm clock goes off, God's going, hey, get up. And if Phoebe's diaper needs changing, God's saying, it's time to change the baby. Do the next indicated thing. Don't do your grandiose idea. Do the next indicated thing, and you can rest assured that you are doing God's will for you. Now, if my father had told me that, or a friend had told me that who wasn't an alcoholic, I would not have heard him. But somebody who is baffled by life the way I was because of my alcoholism explained in very simple terms what God's will for me was, and it changed my life. I could do that. I want to tell you one of the things that happened is I was saying that prayer, relieve me of the bondage of self that I might better do thy will. And my sponsors, I told my sponsor, because I can't do something good without somebody knowing about it, and because then it's like I didn't do it at all. And He said, you know, prayer is great, but action's really where it's at. And I said, oh, so I thought about, well, how do I relieve myself of the bondage of self? And I go to the Herbosa Beach Men's Stag. It's a big meeting. And this guy got called on and he said, I'm visiting from Australia. I'll be visiting once a month. So I just want to introduce myself. So my big relief from the bondage of self, my great idea was to remember his name. So when he came back a month later, it was like a seventh grade dance. I was like pushing past people to go talk to him. Don't nobody talk to him. And I walked up to him. I said, hey, Kevin, welcome back to the meeting. And he said, wow, you remembered my name. And I said, this is the greatest meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. And I'm just so glad that you're here. Must be difficult traveling. You don't know anyone. And he said, come outside with me. And he said, what do you do for a living? I said, well, I stack newspapers on a loading dock and I deliver packages. And I'm a content professional. And he said, why don't you come to my office? And he gave me his card. And he said, you know, we can maybe come work for me. And he was the vice president of this huge international airline. And I went to this, I brought my DMV, you know, the phone book, read out. And I had a brown suit on and black shoes because I didn't have any brown shoes. And I went to this thing and the human resources person said, yeah, I'm supposed to interview you for a job at the airport. So I went in and I handed her my DMV. And I sat there nervously thinking she's going to find out who I am and kick me out of here. And she took my resume, whatever it was, application, and my DMV, and she went into Kevin's office, which was right next door. And I heard through the wall him yell, you know, I'm going to fly the goddamn plane. She's going to put people on them. And a good alcoholic. And she came back in kind of nervously. And the interview went really well after that. And she said, I guess we're going to hire you. And now, the reason I tell that story is I did not raise my hand at a meeting when they asked for a burning desire and say, I need a job. I tried to relieve myself of the bondage of self and remembered someone's name, and God took care of it. That's what happened. That's my experience. That's how it happened. So I got this job at the airport, and I was able to earn enough money, not quite to move out from my parents' house, but to buy a guitar back. I needed a guitar, and I bought a beautiful guitar, a Taylor Dan Crary acoustic guitar. And if you play guitar, you're jealous of me now. And I bask in your jealousy. And I took that guitar, and I bought it on my way to work. And I wasn't super popular at this airline because I got hired by the vice president, so they thought I was a mole. I remember they used to, like, go, this job is hell, this job is hell. And I'm like, this isn't hell, man. I've been to hell. This is pretty good. And, you know, you met famous people. You could go everywhere you want in the world. If you had two nickels, you could go anywhere you want in the world. I didn't have two nickels, but I could if I wanted to go anywhere in the world. And they had an employee bus that took you to your car, and I had my guitar there, and I was so excited about this guitar. And I'm standing at this bus stop with my guitar, and this woman who worked for British Airways came up, and I turned to her and I said, can I show you my new guitar? And she looked at me and she said, I don't look at strange men's guitars. And she got on the bus. So I had to get on the bus. I mean, it's the employee bus. So I followed her on the bus, and I go, you know what? Why don't we talk for a minute? We won't be strangers. Then you can look at my guitar. And she's like, whoa. And she had this book in her hand called Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. And she said, I said, hey, I've read that book. She said, well, cut to the chase. Do you believe in God? I said, God saved my life. You know, bad pickup line number two. And but I wasn't hitting on her. I wasn't. She just happened to randomly stand there, and I wanted to show somebody my guitar. And but I did notice that while I was talking to her, I was completely comfortable in my own skin. And she was lovely. She was stunningly beautiful. And it didn't intimidate me, and I was fine with me. And we got off the bus, and I said, you know what, let's forget the guitar. Do you want to have dinner sometime? And she came back at me with, like, can't the girl wait for a bus? And this beautiful British voice, and took off. And I realized the next day that I had grown spiritually, because I went to work the next day, and I didn't tell anybody that she was a lesbian. I'm okay, she's okay, we're okay. And I'm only half kidding, people, because she rejected me. I have nothing against lesbians. Sometimes I love them, but it would clearly make it, you know, she rejected my gender, not me, clearly. But I didn't have to be that way because I liked me. I had done some work. I liked me. That's all right if she doesn't like me. That's not a huge surprise. She's really, really pretty. But she came back up to that bus stop that day, and I didn't have my guitar, and I thought, well, she won't recognize me. I don't have a guitar. She tapped me on my shoulder and said, you know, I believe I was rude to you. Would you like to miss this bus and have a cup of coffee? And we're married now almost 11 years. And there's some things about that are absolutely stunning. The first is she proposed to me because I'm not about to ask her out again, you know. And my wife, I said to my sponsor when we were first courting each other, we got married actually very quickly, and I kissed the ground every day that I married her. And when I was dating her, I said, you know, she's not blonde, she's not anorexic, she's not addicted to heroin, she's really not my type. And he said, you've changed. And he was right. This was a woman who didn't need me. And for the first time in my life, that was attractive to me. She was completely self-sufficient. She was short. She had dark hair. She looked like Audrey Hepburn. I'm in. And that not needing me and that choosing to be with me, it still today takes my breath away. When I'm in my house and she's in another room, I can't believe my luck. I can't believe it. She's like a wild animal that sits next to me. It's incredible for me. It's a great journey. And I got to tell you, I was standing on a pier in Crystal Lake, Illinois, where I was going to get married. My mom had not passed away yet, and that was where she was from. And my father and my mother were there, and my bride was getting ready in the house. And I said to God, I looked up at the sky, and I said, thank you, God, that this is the next indicated thing. Because sometimes the next indicated thing is not a dirty diaper or a bill or an alarm clock. Sometimes the next indicated thing makes your heart explode. That is the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a job when my boss used to say when I was drinking, if you could just get out of your own way, you'd be a force to reckon with. And I go, how the hell do you get out of your own way? I wanted to know. And the way you do that is you start thinking about other people. And you start doing things for other people. Michael said it beautifully. It's about service to other people. I have to tell you, I had a panel up at San Francisco Fire Camp. And there's a part in the big book that says, Jim, remember Jim, the car dealer? He's now working for a dealership he used to own. There's a line in there that has haunted my sobriety. It's early in the book, and it says, all went well for a while for Jim, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And if you put my sobriety on a timeline, one might say, all went well for a while with Matthew. So I had this fire camp panel, and I was living in Long Beach now, and my home group is in Hermosa Beach. It's our panel, and the panel is up near Magic Mountain. It's a long way from my house. And I didn't want to go. I had a week. It was a holiday weekend, and I was in charge of the panel. Three guys had signed up to go with me, and I'm supposed to meet them at the Alano Club, and I thought, oh, God, I can't believe I have to do this. I want to be at home with my hot wife. And I drove up to Hermosa Beach, and none of the guys showed up, which is unusual in my group. We're into service, but it was a holiday weekend. I don't know if they forgot or whatever, but they weren't there. So my first thought was, I don't have to go. Right? Because who's going to know? It's a good deed. And if no one knows, it didn't happen. And so I got on to... But the thing about AA that was different from all my religious upbringing is people in Alcoholics Anonymous showed me Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't tell me. I read a line this morning in my room, a Zen Buddhist saying that says, you cannot teach a path. You can only take a path. And the guys in AA didn't teach me. They took me with them. So I knew that guys with lots of time, with pretty wives and good jobs, went on panels. So I couldn't, with a good conscience, go home. So I drove to San Francisco Fire Camp, and many times I wanted to turn around. And I got to San Francisco, and I pulled into the parking lot, and I opened my door, and the routine is you go inside and you tell somebody that you are the panel, they announce it, and you go into the mess hall. Well, there was this huge African-American guy standing there when I opened my car, and he said, "Are you Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, yeah, I guess. And he said, "I need to talk to you." And we went down on the yard. So I haven't gone and checked in. We're sitting down on the yard where they have picnics and stuff. And he's sitting far from me at the other end of this picnic table. And I'm sitting at caddy corner. And he starts talking to me about how he felt when he got back into prison and threw away another family. And he starts talking to me about how he felt when he couldn't stop drinking, even though all he wanted to do in the world was stop drinking. And he started talking to me about how I felt. And I fell in love with him. I felt in love with him. I felt an arc between us, an energy between us that only we understand. And it got really dark, and I couldn't even see him. It was just a voice. And every once in a while, I'd try to tell him my experience, strength, and hope, and he'd go, shh, shh, shh. And he'd keep telling me his pain. And there's a part of this program that we always forget. It's been talked about many times this weekend, except this part. AA is one alcoholic talking to another. That means one is listening. Take that into your morning meditation. Because my form of listening is waiting till you shut up so I can tell you what I think. But all I did was listen to this guy. And on the way home, I floated home. And I'd realized that I'd enlarged my spiritual life. And all I did was go somewhere. It had nothing to do with me. I brought my ears to do God's work in spite of the fact that I didn't want to do it. It doesn't say we happily did this stuff. It doesn't say we enthusiastically did this stuff. It doesn't say if you want to do this stuff. You cannot want to do it and still grow spiritually. And that is my experience. I drove home, I opened the door, and my wife was better looking. It was weird. So I want to tell you really quickly about a spiritual experience I've had. I've told you a little bit about my wife. We had two children together, and I was in the right car with the woman who was pregnant, and I went to the right hospital. That in itself is a spiritual experience. And I've been through some things that financially, and I finally got a good job. I finally became a drug dealer. I'm a pharmaceutical salesman. I'm getting my money back. Come on, man. So, but I just got this job, and we were going to get ahead financially. I had just gotten this job. My offer had come the day before, and my wife in the morning was looking kind of tired that next day. And I said, "I'll take the kids to the park, and you just rest." And she was making some British food, and I had I wish I could remember, because you guys go, "Oh yeah, that's British." That wasn't kidney pie, but it was damn close. And I had a pager on, and I walked out of my house, and I got the kids in the car, and I started up the car, and I started to leave, and my pager went off, and I didn't have my cell phone with me, and I thought it might be this new job. So I went back into my house, and my wife was lying on the ground, and she'd had a serious stroke, a massive stroke, and her face was distorted, and the kids, like, stepped right over her and went out in the backyard to play. Kids were just oblivious, and I looked at her, and I said, "You've had a stroke," and she looked up at me and said, "Don't call an ambulance," because she's British, and she hates to be the center of attention, and I called an ambulance, and the ambulance took me to my hospital. I live in Long Beach. It's a big city, and they took one look at her and said, "We need to call a helicopter. We need to get you to UC Irvine. She's in trouble." I was scared. I called my sponsor, my sister, and her parents in England. I flew in a helicopter to UC Irvine with my wife, and we went in, and they were going to do this surgery that was going to save her life. They're going to run this thing up her leg and sprinkle this stuff on her brain. And they stopped, and they all walked away, and they said, "We can't do anything for her." I was devastated. I stayed with my wife and lied to her and told her everything was going to be fine. And I went out there, and my sister and my brothers and sisters were in this weird alcove for the family. And I walked out into the waiting room, and guys from Alcoholics Anonymous were there. To this day, my wife says, when I wake up and Bill and Jay are leaning over me, I know something really bad happened. So my wife got airlifted, and I got some advice from my sponsor. I said, you know, I should call them and tell them that I can't go to training. I just got in this job. I needed to go to training for 5 weeks in Chicago. And he said, no, you will not do that. You will be a worker among workers. We will take care of your wife. Go there and don't tell anybody that your wife had a stroke and knock them dead. Again, not my thought, counterintuitive, but I took his advice. I've become to rely on him. And I went there, and I worked hard, because this is our income now. And every time I left my class, there was 2,000 people in this hotel who worked for this company, and they were all ruining their marriages and going to sports bars at night and acting like crazy people. And I would walk out, and I got a lot of crap for this, checking my messages on my cell phone, because I wanted to see if my wife was alive. And I walk out into the hallway, and there'd be 10 messages from you. 15 messages from you. No exaggeration. I'm prone to exaggeration. I'm Irish. No exaggeration. Every 3 hours for 5 weeks, went to see your wife. She's looking okay. She's going to be all right. We took your kids to dinner. We put your Christmas lights up. We mowed your lawn. How could I drink? I was 3,000 miles from home. I was terrified, and I was in a very intense class on the cardiovascular system. And every night I'd walk up to my room, I'd play my guitar, I'd call my wife, and I'd pray to God to have one more day so that I could do what was needed for me to do. Now, the spiritual experience that I want to tell you about happened during this time. I would fly home on the weekends, which is the irony is everybody thought I was going into the city to party during the weekends because I was such a straight arrow during the week. But we were right across the street from the airport, and I have a lot of connections with airlines. And I would go across the street and make some phone calls and get on an airplane and go to UC Irvine, and I'd get there late because that's how it worked out, and my wife would be in bed. Now, one of the times I did this, it was either two or three weeks into it, I walked into her room, and she looked much worse than I remembered. I had made her better in my head. I had made her well in my head to comfort myself, and she clearly was paralyzed, and she clearly had brain damage, and we were clearly in trouble. And I looked at her, and she barely woke up, but this was becoming routine, so I climbed into bed with her, and I wrapped my arms around her, and I fell asleep. And I woke up at about 4 or 4:30 in the morning, full of fear. Fear like I had never experienced in sobriety. And I got out of bed, and the nurses were used to this, and they had left me soap and shampoo and stuff and towels. So I went and I picked this stuff up. I thought, well, I'll go take a shower. And I walked into the hallway of that hospital, and I thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown. I thought I was going to implode from fear. And every step that I took, I thought, I'm going to fall over and faint right now. I am going to have a nervous breakdown. And it was like one flew over the cuckoo's nest, a hospital at 4:30 in the morning. You hear little beeps and moans. And I'm walking down the hallway, and I'm terrified. And I walked into this big shower. It's a real orthopedic shower. And I put my stuff down. I took off my clothes, and I turned on the water, and I got down on my knees. And I prayed a prayer like I have never prayed, straight to God. My sponsor used to tell me to pray with intention that your prayers are being answered. And I prayed from my heart, not my head, to God. And I said, God, you don't have to heal my wife. You don't have to make me a lot of money. You don't have to take care of my children. But I need some of your power because I have none. And I am so afraid right now that I'm not going to be able to do this, to take care of them, to do this new job. And I stood up, and nothing had changed. I was just cleaner. 11 step. And I put my clothes on, and I walked back down that hallway. And each step I was going, okay, I'm going to have a heart attack or a nervous breakdown. And I thought, well, screw it. I'm in a hospital. And the next step, I'm going to have a heart attack. I'm so afraid. I'm shaking. I was physically shaking. And I walked into her room. It's about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I couldn't see her. It was really dark. I couldn't see her. I came from the light hallway into the dark room. So I sat down in the chair next to her bed, and I closed my eyes, and I realized that I could feel her. I could feel her in the room with me. And I thought, I wonder if this is a sixth sense of truly loving someone. And I could feel her. And I kind of academically thought, well, if she were in a big house and I were blind, would I know what room she was in? I walked into the room. So I opened my eyes and I stood up and I put my hands on the railing next to her bed. And I looked across her out the window. I didn't want to look at her because she was really in bad shape. And I looked out the window and it was just barely light. It was like dark blue and just slightly lighter blue. And these trees were silhouetted in the window. And these birds were flying from tree to tree. And it just struck me, like in my heart, how beautiful the world is. I mean, it was a weird sort of realization, like, God, that's amazing. And then I looked down at my wife, and she has this light, pale Welsh skin that's just gorgeous, gorgeous skin. And I looked down at her, and I thought, I love her so much. And there was no fear. Not any fear. And I realized, I'm not alone. I have great love in my life. And all I have to do is the next indicated thing, and everything's going to be all right. And I've done that. And I can tell you today, standing here with a wife who's disabled, with two children who are a lot of work, and Phoebe, who's living with her mom with me, that I don't want anybody else's life. I don't want a different wife. And I don't want my wife any different than she is today. And I have only you to thank for that. Thanks for letting me share.
Hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.